Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Studio 18 in Campo Robles, Spain. In tonight's episode, our 44th, we explore the geographies of everything with world-renowned geographer Yifu Tuan. Stay tuned. Born in China in 1930 and was educated in Australia, the Philippines, England, and the United States. He holds degrees from the University of Oxford, his BA and MA, and the PhD from the University of California, Berkeley. He has taught at Indiana University, the University of New Mexico, the University of Toronto, and the University of Minnesota. In 1984, he became professor of geography at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he was the J.K. Wright Professor and Villis Research Professor. Professor Tuan was a Guggenheim Fellow in 1968 and 69. In 1973, he received an award for meritorious contribution to geography from the Association of American Geographers. He was elected a Fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science in 1986. In 2001, was named Fellow of the British Academy. In 2002, Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. A well-published geographer. I will go through a little bit the selection of his bibliography, going back to 1968 with The Hydrologic Cycle and the Wisdom of God, Man and Nature in 1971, The Climate of New Mexico in 1973, Topophilia, A Study of Environmental Perception, Attitudes, and Values, published in 1974, and perhaps the first of his major works. That certainly when we measure that by what graduate students and academic geography departments are reading today, and reading from Tuan specifically. The other would be in 1977, his Space and Place, The Perspective of Experience. Certainly a key text in any history of geographical thought, or for those interested in cultural geography. This is a key text, really looking at two of geography's main concepts and main themes, space and place. In 1979, he published Landscapes of Fear. 1982, Segmented Worlds and Self, Group Life and Individual Consciousness. Dominance and Affection, The Making of Pets in 1984, The Good Life in 1986, Morality and Imagination, Paradoxes of Progress in 1989, Passing Strange and Wonderful, Aesthetics, Nature, and Culture in 1993, Cosmos and Hearth in 1996, Escapism 1998, Who Am I? An Autobiography of Emotion, Mind, and Spirit, and then his Dear Colleague collection, Common and Uncommon Observations, published in 2002. These are letters to his colleagues. Place, Art, and Self in 2004. Coming Home to China in 2007. Published 77 years after he was born. And then Human Goodness, 2008. Religion from Place to Placelessness in 2010, and Romantic Geography in Search of the Sublime Landscape in 2013. As we follow that through the chronology of his bibliography, we're hearing definitely a greater engagement with the philosophy behind geographical thinking over the course of his career. We also hear hit the wide range of interests. Anything from pets to sublime landscapes. Really, I think what we're getting back at are, in major themes, a discussion of our identity and how place shapes that and how we shape the places in which we live. Chuan had revolutionary and innovative ideas about human geography, and more specifically, humanistic geography. For instance, there are a lot of thoughts about the relationship between human geography and philosophy, psychology, and religion today. It was in the 1960s and 1970s that Chuan was perhaps a pioneer in this area of study. He's one of the first geographers that considered a strong relationship between these different areas and ways of thinking. Chuan is very interested in the way people feel and think about place and space. He's also interested in how people are attached to their homes, their neighborhoods, their town, their city, their country. We welcome him to the show. This is an honor for us to have someone who is read by any or most, if not all, graduate students in human geography in the United States and perhaps in the UK. This is an excellent opportunity for the show to really speak with someone who's had influence on the framing and the initiation of our idea and the concept of geographical imaginations and the exploration of that. And so we welcome him and look forward to hearing back from you about the audience, about your questions, about the discussion with Yifu Tuan right after this break. Come back. You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. As a geography, as a graduate student in geography, two of the concepts that we talk a lot about are the concepts of place and space. And no doubt do we read, your seminal work from the 1970s about the topic. How do you define place and space? And has that shifted over the years?
Well, it has elaborated over the years. Let me start with this. I was invited to give a talk to middle school students 11, 12 years old, on place and space. So I felt that was a real challenge. I didn't know why middle school student would be interested in it.
Right.
And I've never spoken to children. And I went there quite nervous, so I started by saying, well, this is a special class. I was invited a guest. Some of your schoolmates are on a boat trip, which was an alternate session from my talk. And I said, my topic, assigned topic is space and place. Let me try to explain it, that your fellow students are having a great time out there on the lake, on a boat. They're out there in space, and they're having a great time, but there is a risk the boat might sink. Right? And the children nodded, yeah, that's possible. So I said, out there it's exciting, but there are also risks. Now, that is what I meant by space. Now, place is where we are now in this classroom, which is familiar to you. And it's safe. On the other hand, it's a little boring, isn't it? And they said, yeah, it's boring. So that didn't go well. But anyway, I think they basically got the idea that place is somehow familiar and nurturing, and space is unfamiliar, exciting, but it has its risks. So that's my explanation to these children. But in my class, one way that I introduced place and space concept was something like this, that I contrasted the traditional Chinese house with the American, rather typical American ranch house. I said the difference is that Chinese emphasizes place, the home, the courtyard is an intimate, enclosed place that it's a courtyard, so it's surrounded by walls, and from the outside it's nondescript. You don't see anything.
Yeah.
And from inside, you don't see outside. There are no windows on the wall. So you say that the courtyard is the open space, but it doesn't present a view. There's no view. It's too small. So the only space in the traditional Chinese courtyard is the sky. But it's not a view. You don't, at least we don't think of the sky above us as a view. And so I contrast that with the American house, what's the style they're called, ranch house.
Right.
With a large living room and a big window looking out to the garden and beyond. I said to the students that when I was new to America, I would be invited with other students to a professor's house, home, for dinner. So we go there, we enter the front door, and I find that people, my fellow students invited, would somehow move across the living room and stand in front of the window and look out and say nice words about the view they see from it. I was still new to America, and I thought, well, this is really bizarre and even rude. How can the guests not admire the living room?
The inside, yeah.
But move to the window and admire what's outside it. But then later I grew wise and thought it made sense, because they're admiring what's outside the living room. The living room allowed the professor to have a good view what's outside. And there's a word for another word for view, and that is prospect, a good prospect. But prospect also carries the meaning of future.
Yeah.
What is your prospect? So if you're admiring the view, you're admiring the prospect. You're saying something good about the good prospect, good future.
Yes, it's not just space, but time, yeah.
Right, time. And it's very American, because Americans were future-oriented, and space-oriented, in contrast to the Chinese and to the Chinese house.
I mean, it's interesting. So the concepts, these concepts, place in space. We can't. I mean, people spend careers debating them and investigating them and exploring them as academic geographers, but they're very debatable. But even then, cross-cultural, in China, this idea of place or space might be very different than an American sense of place.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the cultural difference. And then, at the most abstract level, you know, I would say to my class that that pace, I mean, we use the word here, where I am is my place, and there is where, is out there, and beyond there is yonder. So here, there, yonder, are equivalent terms to place and space.
Yeah.
Place is here, space is there, or yonder, yonder, and time is evolved too. So here is now, and place is now, is here, and space is out there.
Can we use the Latin terms terra cognita and terra incognita to help this?
Yeah.
Is this a similar relationship?
Yes, it's similar, and but I was trying to get to the notion that that the place and space is not only geographical, but involves the notion of here,
yeah,
and there, and time-wise, now and then. Now is here. Then could be in the future. I'll take care of it in the future. I'll take it then. And then I'll do this.
Yeah.
But then it could also be past. So what is out there in space could be future or past.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. I'm reading a quote here from an article, again, from, I believe, the late 70s. Place is a center of meaning constructed by experience. So
yeah,
it's really
right.
About meaning, too, isn't it?
Yes, right, yes. And, well, it's also about meaning because, you know, we need a pause. We
yeah.
need time, as it were, to come to a stop or slow down, in order to gain a sense of place, which also means in order to get a sense of who we are. But time doesn't really stop in this way. And I mean, personally, life goes on. I'm getting older all the time. And this is a one-direction march to old age and finally death.
So you mentioned something here about identity. Like, how much do you How much do you think place shapes who we are?
Yes, I think place has a great subtle influence on who we are. And it matters in ways that we are probably not aware of. So to give just one example, I used to, when I was fully functioning as a teacher, professor, I had a big office, two layers of it. And when I retired, I moved to a much smaller office, which was a cubicle. Well, I liked the smaller office much better than the big one.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I explained it is this, that in the big office, I feel that my ideas keep floating away from me into the corners of this big office, and they are no longer accessible to me. It's as though what I'm thinking becomes diluted because they float away into corners of this big office, whereas in my geometrical cubicle, much smaller office, they are contained there. And I felt much more comfortable. That's how I explained it. Perhaps it's rationalization, but I did feel better and more productive in my small office. And when people ask me why, well, that's the kind of explanation I offered.
You could probably share that with the University of Wisconsin building staff.
Right.
To limit office space size or something.
Right, but this is kind of interesting. I mean, this is no doubt personal, and the same with living in a house or in a large apartment. I don't feel comfortable when I'm constantly aware of rooms that are empty, that I've not used. That haunts me. I feel it's not my house because there are parts of it which is not me.
Yeah.
I want a house where, in the course of a day, I would be in every corner of it, you know, in the kitchen, in the dining room, in the study, and so on, and not have rooms that are just blank. That's bothering me. So there are things like that that we're not normally aware of. And showing how, you know, where we live very much affect our sense of well-being, actually.
Yeah. What if we continued with the scale sort of here and went to the neighborhood or Madison, Wisconsin? Has that place shaped you? I mean, there's probably no question about that, right?
Yes. It's not, I mean, Madison is a very appealing place for me and for lots of people because basically it's on an isthmus between two lakes. I'm looking at the lake right now as I speak with you.
And it's frozen.
In my bedroom.
Here. Yeah.
Yeah. The sun is pouring in and I see the lake. That's one lake. If I go to the other side, I could see the other lake.
Huh.
And the isthmus is a strip in the middle, which is then anchored by two institutions and buildings. One is the Bascom Hall, the administration building of the university, and the other end is a dome, the capital of the state. Again, there's certain symmetry to it that I like the cubicle of my study, that these two features of nature, two lakes, Lake Mendota and Lake Monona, with the university, and the state. So I like that very much, and it's the sort of thing that I feel I need, you know, beyond the house, beyond the home. The neighborhood has this clarity and beauty to it, too.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. Geographical Imaginations is a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring together academic and everyday geographical or spatial thinking. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions. How does blank inform the way I picture the world in my head? And how does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world? The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrik in Salzburg, Austria. In each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world. Now let's get back to our episode. A favorite quote that people like to use of yours is, "A great city may be seen as the construction of words as well as stone."
Yes, right, yes. Yes, I became fascinated by how important words play. So I was a student at Oxford, and I mean, it's claimed to be a city of dreaming spires, dreaming towers, and that's very poetic utterance. And it's still kind of true. There are these beautiful spires, towers of the colleges, a city of dreaming towers. But as geographers, we know that this is a very small part of Oxford. It's really pretty much an industrial city.
Yeah.
But the industries do not have what Matthew Arnold to write poems about it. The core city of colleges do, and it's just endless. You can't go there without thinking of Alice in Wonderland.
Right.
And just goes on and on, because I used to get this magazine from Oxford, and the magazine would end with recent books published about Oxford. Not only scholarly books, not only tourist books, but also, say, murder stories. Dorothy Sayers, Lord, whoever.
Right.
You know, they continue, these stories continue to talk about the place, Oxford.
Yeah.
Building it up into something that the other parts of the city, Oxford, certainly lack, and so become invisible, practically.
Hmm. Yeah, so all of these things, these texts, these images, they all go into, these are representations of the place, essentially. Do they all go into formulating our imagination of the place?
Well, another thing I point out is, that Chinese poets have an easier time than American poets.
Uh-huh.
And that's because the poet would mention a city, and that city, that word for the city, immediately becomes very evocative because of what is known about it and what is written about it. Whereas in America, the cities may be beautiful, but it doesn't have the literary depth to support it. So a American poet, say, in a line mentions Bloomington, it doesn't, it's not evocative in the way that a small town in China could be very evocative, thanks to the poets and that's mentioned it earlier.
Yeah. So language constructing sort of some of our ideas about a place and our imagining of that place?
Right. So it's not only the architecture.
Yeah.
The architecture is closed in with words, with evocative language. It just makes you think a little, because there is the river, Chao River, at Oxford, and students punt there, as I did. But floating in the river, I can't help thinking of, this Carol telling stories to little girls.
Yeah.
Including Alice, of course. That makes me think of how important, in a way, education is to our appreciation of things and of place.
Yeah. Do you think film has the same sort of power to shape our perceptions of a place? I think of New York, for instance. New York is in so many different films, and it then gets exported around the world because of American cinema is being seen in Spain as much as it is in Nepal, maybe in different places around the world. And so people get these ideas about New York, much like they might have from books.
Right. Yes. That's interesting too, because again, in the old days, if the story is set in New York, all the director needs to do is to have an opening shot of skyscrapers
right.
in the distance, and you know it's going down in New York, Manhattan. But since then, it's less clear, because almost all the big cities in the world, in China, for instance, just about every city has that kind of towering skyscraper outline.
So it's not as iconic as
right.
it used to be. Yeah, right.
Right.
Huh.
Yeah. On the other hand, it is important because the older stories set in New York would have a shot of the skyline, and it would include the Twin Towers.
Right.
Which were, so later stories, they're no longer there. And me, that's a shock.
And the new tower probably isn't as iconic as the Twin Towers.
Right. You will have to wait for
people have
more
to,
films to be
right.
made with
right.
it as background. Yeah.
Hmm.
Right.
You mentioned Bloomington before, Bloomington, Indiana.
Yeah.
There's one film that I always, it's what makes me think of Bloomington, and it's a bicycle story, and
Breaking Away.
So whenever I hear Bloomington,
whenever I hear Bloomington,
I think of cycling on a highway, trying to keep up with an 18-wheeler, which is one of the scenes from the film. You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode. The name of our show is Geographical Imaginations. How much is this, what we're talking about, how much is this, of this is a geographical imagination? And is place, does place shape that imagination? Or is place just an example of a geographical imagination? It's a way of ordering our world. You know, the term is used in human geography. There's certainly a few articles, a book about it. I mean, it is a concept that academic geographers have spoken about and debated about. How does this fit into some of your own research? Are there any parallels between this concept of geographical imagination and place?
Yes, well, I think it's pretty central, and it comes down to the fact that we humans have a mind or intelligence, and this operates, this affects, of course, how we experience the world around us. To take one example of geographical imagination, and that is the notion of migration. Now, as I see it, migration is a matter, well, everyone sees it, it's a matter of push and pull. But with animals, it's almost all push. And that is, they migrate because their ecological base has, for some reason, deteriorated or it's been threatened.
Yeah.
So they're pushed out of it. For us humans, it's both. Of course, often it's a push. Life is intolerable where we were, so we move. But it's also pull. This is very clear in stories of migration, perhaps particularly in the U.S., Europeans coming over here. It's such a clear function of both being pushed by deteriorating conditions at home in Europe.
Yeah.
And what they imagined life would be in the New World. That's a real draw.
Yeah.
I don't think that animals imagine greener pastures, but not a whole reality that they want.
Not an American dream, for instance.
Right. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, it operates at this level, but also clearly at the other level, too, that I mentioned earlier about how literature and words build up place.
Yeah.
Language is unique to humans.
And language could then construct meaning around a place that then, affects our imagination of that place. What we think of
right.
It, what we think we might experience there, all of those things.
Yes, right. There are things also that may be not unique to humans, but certainly also help expanded, deepened with the mind, and that's the notion of haunted, that a place is haunted.
Yeah.
Let's say there's a beautiful house that is on the market, and it costs a lot of money to buy it. But then a murder occurred in it, and immediately the value of the house plummets, even though, I mean, physically it's the same.
Right.
It's just that the horrible event is going to affect the cost of the value of the house.
Yeah.
And
the people that know what happened there it'll change the way they look at that place.
Every
time they drive by it, and yeah.
Right. Yes. It's. And I also I'm a little bit baffled by why haunted has this negative meaning. Why couldn't it be haunted by beauty?
Yeah, right.
Well, in a sense, it can. I used to live in a condo, which was a converted school, elementary school. It's called Doty School, but the school is converted into apartments, and I had a nice apartment there, and I said I liked it for various reasons, but one reason is that when I can't sleep at night, I would evoke sound and images of little kids running around, and that's some sweet and calming.
Yeah.
But I said, suppose it's a converted hospital.
Yeah.
You know, that wouldn't work for me. Yeah.
Right, or worse, like a film version would be the psychiatric ward of a hospital.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check us out online at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
Are these imaginations personal or collective or both?
Well, I think it's, you know, kind of collective, certainly.
Yeah.
The haunted house, if some bad thing happened in it, its price is going to drop, and that's not personal. I think that's widely shared.
Yeah.
But there are personal things which actually led me to do the kind of work I've been doing. And that's one of my first jobs was at New Mexico, teaching there.
Right.
And I had a brother who was teaching in Hawaii, University of Hawaii. The geography department at the University of Hawaii kept inviting me to join their faculty. They couldn't quite understand why I resisted the temptation. I stayed in New Mexico, Albuquerque. They said, well, join us in Island Paradise. So I visited, but I still resisted. And I found it at first hard to explain, but basically, I prefer the desert to the island paradise.
Yeah.
At first, I couldn't understand why. I mean, I found it hard to explain it to people. And that led to, you know, writing the book that turned out to be Topophilia.
Yeah.
Basically trying to explain to others why I have this preference. It's not unique to me, of course, but it is not common either.
So this idea of a connection, a sense of a connection to the sense of place? I mean, would we say that? Or a connection, a sense of belonging to a certain landscape? Is that...
Yeah, well, another one of my, I think, a personal response, and that led me to Cetopophilia, and that was, I loved the desert because, well, for two things. One is that I never felt lost in it because I could always find a landmark, a peak standing out in the distance, or if not that, at least the sun gives me a sense of direction.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I also lived in the Philippines for a time and was kind of familiar with the tropical rainforest. And one day I was there with a group, and I separated from them and stepped into 100 yards or so into the depths of the rainforest. And I was totally lost. I didn't know whether to go forward or backward. And there's nothing that tells me, there's no landmark in the tropical rainforest. And I couldn't see the sun either. So it was a frightening experience for me. So there's one thing, this thing that in the wide open space of the desert, I feel oriented.
Yeah.
If only by the sun. In the tropical rainforest, I could be totally disoriented. So that's one thing. The second thing, I mean, this makes sense, but the second thing is a little different, maybe more personal, and that is, in the midst of life in the tropical rainforest, all I was aware of was death. That is, I see decay everywhere.
Hmm.
I mean, that's kind of perverse, but I see trees rotting, dead animals. But in the desert, which to some people symbolize, well, lack of life, certainly.
Right, right.
To me, it transcends this biological cycle. And I'm comforted by that.
Yeah. So I think this is a good place to stop a kind of a midway point in what was an hour and a half long conversation with Yifu Tuan, a world prominent human geographer whose ideas really have shaped this show and some of the inquiry involved with this show, asking questions about how it is we know our world and the humanistic approach of which Yifu Tuan is a pioneer. It really, I think, fits well with what we're doing here, as well as the previous episodes with the work of J.K. Wright. And if we go back to our first episode of the show, Doreen Massey, a number of different geographers who have influenced, I think, the way we even started the way we framed this show and this public geography initiative from the beginning. And that said, we are a public geography project, and what that means is that we're bringing those academic geography or geographers' ideas to discussion with a wider audience. We're also a public geography project because we're involving and looking at the perspectives of a wide range of people, very much in line with J.K. Wright's idea of geosophy. So I at least for now, want to thank Yifu for joining with us in this first of two episodes, what we call the first episode, Geographies of Everything, the next episode,
geographies of nothing. That said, we're very excited about the continuing that conversation next month. As always, we thank the Art of Escapism for their song and use of their song, The Water Embers. You can find them on Royalty Free Music and give them a listen. There's a whole wide range of other music as well. So without anything else, let's meet up next month to continue our conversation with Yifu Tuan. Until then, ciao. See you.